Nancy Garrido, accused of holding J.C. Dugard captive in their backyard for more than 18 years, are due in court today. There's been speculation about a possible plea deal in the case. Nancy Garrido's attorney told the Associated Press his client will not be changing her plea to guilty in time for today's hearing because the last offer from prosecutors had her serving 180 years to life. President Obama says he's planning a trip to Ireland in May. He made the announcement during a joint appearance today with Ireland's Prime Minister, Enda Kenny. Tonight, the President and First Lady will be hosting a St. Patrick's Day reception for Kenny at the White House. I'm Nancy Lyons, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Healthcare Compact Alliance, working for citizen control of healthcare. Information at healthcarecompact.org.
You'll find thousands of used albums, plus CDs, videotapes, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the 2011 Vintage Vinyl Sale, held on April 30th. We'll be at the new site, the former Altman's Billiard and Barstool Supply, located at 301 West Market View Drive in Champaign. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader.
On the next Fresh Air, director Greg Mottola. His new sci-fi comedy, Paul, is about two British slackers who encounter a small alien. Mottola says his alien is a computer-generated graphic, but he didn't want to make a spectacle.
I wanted to take our very expensive CGI character and treat him like he is a character in a road movie. He is Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces.
Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In this part of the show, we'll go to the Focus archives for a program we first broadcast in January of this year, January 28th. So that means that during this hour, we will not take calls. In the 1950s, the American South was seen as a backward place by much of the rest of the country because of the persistence of segregation. But within a generation, it seemed that the South had not only caught up with the North, it had actually become the embodiment of a new America. Perceptions changed again after the presidency of Jimmy Carter as the South returned to its more traditional and conservative character. These kinds of ups and downs lead to a big question that we'll be talking about this morning, and that is how it is that the South fits into America, and have the changes that we've seen in the last 50 years or so made the South more a part of America, or is there some way in which the United States has always been profoundly Southern? Some of the questions that we'll take up this morning with our guest, James Cobb. He is a professor of history at University of Georgia, well-regarded as an historian of the American South, has authored a number of books, including one that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is The South and America Since World War II, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. So if you're interested, you can seek it out. Our guest, as I mentioned, is the Spaulding Distinguished Research Professor of Southern History and Culture at University of Georgia. He is former president of the Southern Historical Association and has written widely on the interaction between economy, society, and culture in the American South. And Professor Cobb, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the chance to visit with you.
You know, I think that it is really interesting that for such a long time, and maybe in some people's minds still, people both in the North and the South, they thought of the South, and I guess here what we're talking about is that part of the country south of the Mason-Dixon line and east of the Mississippi, as being something other, as being a very alien place. And this was not just something that Northerners thought. I think that a lot of Southerners thought the same thing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, in fact, you know, there were a lot of Southerners who were actively contributing to this perception. I mean, the Southern intellectuals sort of leading the way. And, you know, the writings of William Faulkner and Thomas Wolfe, others who wrote, you know, memoirs and sort of exposés of the South from an insider's perspective. So, there was plenty of fuel coming out of the South for this perception, no doubt about it. Mm.
And was that something that is that something that's motivated by pride or by defensiveness, or is it a little of both?
Well, I think a little of both. I think in a lot of ways, Southern intellectuals in the 30s, 40s, and 50s were they're a bit like intellectuals in less developed countries elsewhere in the world who are undergoing, seeing their countries undergo Westernization, you know, or Americanization in a way not unlike what was really happening in the South. And the response to that was, on the one hand, to welcome all these changes for the better, the greater economic prosperity, the improved education, living conditions, et cetera. But on the other was this concern about a complete surrender of cultural identity to, which is, of course, something that you know, obviously we hear from a lot of America's critics in the world today. So that, I think they're sort of sitting in a comparable position. And this is what's motivating him. So that's why I think you get this love-hate relationship in a writer like Faulkner, who, you know, he can't get past all that he sees wrong with the South, but neither can he divest himself of his emotional ties to it.
Mm-hmm. The sort of the jumping off point for this particular book is the Second World War, and I think that it's quite an interesting question here, because I'm sure that if you ask people about, well, what sort of events have made the South the place that it is, and I'm sure in terms of profound change, I'm sure the first thing people say, well, the Civil War, and then I suppose people will say, well, the Civil Rights Movement, and they could have some other things. But what you argue, and I guess what a lot of people argue, is that the Second World War had a profound effect on the South. And in fact, there are some people who are prepared to argue that the Second World War was more important in terms of determining the kind of place the South is, more important actually than the Civil War.
Yes, there are a lot of people who would do that, and I think when you obviously can't, you're definitely into apples and oranges if you're putting the two conflicts beside each other. But I mean, I think it's a fairly strong argument is to be made that say that the South changed more in the relative sense in the first 25 years, say between 1945 and 1970, than it changed between 1865 and 1941. The relative pace, it's just such a compressed and dramatic transformation in terms of the economy, a tremendous shift away from agriculture toward industry, a movement of the population into a way to the cities, off the land, and of course, for a good part of that period, out of the South entirely. And I think that's one of the things that, on the question of, did the South become more American, or was, or the old saw, did the America become more Southern, or my third alternative being that we simply discovered how Southern America had been all along. I think that this, for example, about 1.6, 1.7 million black Southerners left the South in the 1940s alone, moving to northern cities. And, of course, this is part of a much larger outmigration of African Americans that began roughly around 1910, and so you're getting a shift of the black population into northern cities, which is exacerbating a lot of the racial tensions there. So that you're setting up a situation where it's going to be more and more apparent after the war that racism is a problem not just in the South.
The war and the participation of African Americans, soldiers in the war, was very important to helping get the civil rights movement going. And we'll talk some more, I'm sure, about economic factors and the fact that the economic improvement, well, that also was good for African Americans because their economic potential did increase some after the war. But the big thing here is that they went to fight. They put their lives on the line to defend democracy. And then they said, now, wait a minute, we're not going to go back to the life we had before. After what we've done now, fighting for democracy abroad and fighting for the rights of people abroad and fighting for freedom, we're not going to come back and just go back to the way things were. And that there was this very deliberate attempt by organizations like the NAACP to link those two struggles, that is, the fight for freedom abroad and the fight for freedom at home.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was no coincidence that membership in the NAACP increased ninefold during the war itself, and there really was it was very obvious, and certainly it was obvious at the time, but in retrospect, it's extremely clear and pronounced that there really is this sort of emotional transformation that goes on that we're returning. Black veterans are just saying, you know, this is, if not now, when? And you know, this is it, and we're not going to step back into our old roles. And so you get so many of the prominent black leaders who either were part of the civil rights movement or certainly set the stage for it. Who were also veterans of World War II. And another thing that sort of makes a difference, I mean, there had been some of this feeling after black men had gone and fought in World War I, but there was just not, any receptivity to speak of in white America to this sort of, notion that we've earned our full rights as citizens. But after World War II, of course, there is the atmosphere of the Cold War and the concern about the expansion of communism and communist subversion, and the Jim Crow South just becomes increasingly not just an embarrassment, but a real diplomatic obstacle for the United States. So you've got that changed, more receptive environment. In addition to the much more obvious militance of the returning veterans.
Our guest in this hour of focus is James C. Cobb. He's a B. Finnessy Spaulding Distinguished Professor at University of Georgia and has written a good deal about the history of the American South. His most recent book is The South in America Since World War II. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe we could talk a little bit more. You've already sketched it out, but talk a little bit more about how the economy changed with the war. I think you make the argument that maybe the biggest, you can certainly connect the war to the civil rights struggle, that the single biggest impact of the war certainly was economic. And when you see this big move in the United States from, and I suppose particularly also in the South, from an economy that is primarily agrarian and based on agriculture to one that's all about industrial development. And there are a number of things that happen, including mechanization that makes it possible for you don't need as many people working in the fields, and also the development of industry that offered opportunities of jobs in industry in urban areas, that all of these things come together, and it meant for the South some really big changes.
Oh, absolutely. The reach of the impact of the economic changes, reaches over into demographic changes and ultimately into political changes as well. Because when you get what happens during the war is the war drains away, of course, of a lot of the farm labor force, a great percentage of which is never restored. And it certainly, there had been a sort of a, had reached a point in terms of mechanizing the cotton harvest where there's has not been a viable mechanical cotton picker really introduced prior to World War II, but there is tremendous upward pressure on wages because of labor demands among cotton growers in the South during the war, and this sort of becomes the final little straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of pushing toward the technological breakthrough that gives us a mechanical cotton picker. And when, you know, you have a machine that can do the work, some said is of, you know, maybe 40 men in terms of picking cotton, you know, it makes a tremendous difference in terms of the labor needs of the large cotton growers, and essentially it sort of cuts loose a big segment of the old farm labor force who are, you know, no longer able to work in agriculture, and they are available for industrial employment. And of course, this because so many of the towns and cities in the South had been tied economically to agriculture, to processing and supplying the agricultural sector, that they have to sort of switch to emphasizing industrial recruitment and industrial development. And so you get a sort of rapid transfer of population to urban areas. You get a pronounced, dramatic increase in efforts to recruit new industry. And as the populations shift and as the industrial base starts to broaden, you get an increasing political division in the sense of the growing momentum of the urban areas starts to, and their interest now in nationalizing the urban economies and maybe and ultimately globalizing them as well, causes a real division with the old rural political bosses who have been the kingpins and sort of keeping this the racial status quo in the South, so that ultimately, as a town like Atlanta really becomes, both a national and international player, then concerns about racial problems, racial conflict, violence in response to efforts to integrate the schools become paramount because they have a price tag attached to them in terms of the possible loss of future investment. And so this then creates greater receptivity to the efforts of civil rights leaders by the 1960s to sort of take the civil rights movement into the streets or to the lunch counters or on the buses so that the tactics, the shift in tactics to a more activist approach by civil rights leaders corresponds to this heightened sensitivity of white leaders in southern cities to the whole question of how bad racial violence is for your image and for your ultimate ability to recruit new investment.
So their interest in a more progressive sort of attitude towards race was that racism was bad for business.
Yeah, racial violence certainly was bad for business, so you get a more moderate, still, you know, by no means liberal, and a person still likely to prefer, as a personal matter, to prefer segregation even, but one who was no longer willing to stand up for segregation if it meant losing future payrolls and profits from industrial expansion.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting that how these forces brought about a shift in where political power was.
Well, they did, and the southern states had were sort of notorious for having malapportioned legislatures and to favor rural areas, because there'd been this concern for quite some time that the urban areas would be the ones most likely to be susceptible to pressures to make concessions to blacks on voting and integrating facilities. And so part of the plan had been to keep the rural areas as powerful as possible, but the pressure of the population shifts and just the economic power, they lead to various lawsuits and efforts that eventually just bring, they sort of fully enfranchise urban areas, and that makes a tremendous difference, particularly when the Voting Rights Act comes along and offers wholesale enfranchisement to black voters in the South who had been long denied the opportunity to vote. So it's a conjunction. It's a very interesting conjunction of economic and social forces that sort of wind up working in the same direction.
Maybe also you could talk about the how people thought about the federal government or their relationship to the federal government, which I'm sure in some respects were problematic. On the other hand, particularly because of the war, I think a lot of federal money actually came into the South, so that was good. But that represented a different way of thinking or different attitude toward the federal government than what people had had before.
Well, the public attitude of, since Reconstruction, and well, since before Reconstruction, had been of hostility to the federal government, and because the federal government was viewed really as a representative of the North, and it was therefore seen as being likely to interfere somehow in Southern racial affairs, and So there was always a sort of this overall public posture of hostility to Washington, but southern politicians had long understood the benefit of manipulating monies from coming from Washington for things like repairing the levees on the Mississippi River and what have you. And then in the 1930s. The Agricultural Adjustment Act, which paid farmers to take land out of production, was, of course, a huge boon to large landholders in the South. And then the war had come along, and I think there's a good bit of evidence that the Roosevelt administration actually sort of used the war as a third New Deal for the South in terms of creating military facilities and what have you, and about $9 billion of federal money comes into the South during the war, and this has the effect of enhancing the market appeal of the South, so that you're not just talking about the rudimentary, low-wage, labor-intensive kinds of operations that are drawn by cheap labor, but you've got places like Atlanta, the metropolitan areas, where now there's enough buying power to have market attraction, so you get better kinds of industries that are drawn there, not just by labor but by markets. But there is, and this is something that I keep coming back to throughout the book. I mean, there is this sort of the South, on the one hand, has its hand out for every federal dollar it can get, but the stock and trade of the typical Southern politician is beating up on the federal government in every way possible, and of course that all that holds true right down to today. The Southern states make out like bandits in terms of the return on the federal tax revenue that the Southern states send to Washington compared to the money they get. Some states it's about 2-1. So some of it just has to do with the fact that for so long Southerners were reelected. They were, incumbency was far more pronounced among Southern representatives than anybody else, and they were in positions with seniority that they could wield a lot of power in Congress and sort of get things from the government on the one hand, even as they railed out against it.
We are just about at our midpoint here, and I have a caller I'll get right to, and I would just like to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus. We're speaking with James Cobb. He's a professor of history at the University of Georgia. He's written a lot about the history of the American South, and his most recent book is The South and America Since World War II, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send along your thoughts, questions by email. You can write us at will-talk, that's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Effingham. We'll start out with them and line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if your guest might try to cover the a little more defined the transition from chattel slavery to wage slavery, which, you know, is still in existence and is not muted in the South, and the unions that tried to form and now are almost extinct. On Channel 12 last night, I took the time to watch the dilemma of the longshore workers and who were attacked by the National Guard and the Army and the police. But they killed a few people, but they finally won recognition, and now all that has declined away. I don't want to go too far afield, but nevertheless, there was that transition. The mechanized North before the Civil War, and then afterward when chattel slavery didn't exist anymore, and the wage rates for Africans and Caucasians were part of that, too. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, it's certainly true. I mean, under slavery, we now, thanks to the good work of a lot of economic historians, we now understand more fully how important slavery was economically to large slaveholders, because the slaves themselves were the single greatest source of wealth as property, but slave prices having risen fairly dramatically throughout the late antebellum period, and in addition to the labor they performed. And of course, with the emancipation, that is gone. I mean, the wealth value of slaves as property is gone, and white Southerners are scrambling then to sort of regain control of black labor at the cheapest possible level. And what emerges in agriculture is the system of sharecropping, where the former slaves who have only their labor as to bargain with strike agreements with the landholders who have land but no labor to work it. And this proves to be a very exploitive system. There isn't a formal wage system per se, because the capital simply isn't available in the South anymore after slavery to fund anything. And you know, the banks, banks are extremely scarce. So this is a very antiquated system, high interest rates at every level for everybody involved, and it has the effect then when industrialization begins, it has the effect, has a drag effect on wage levels in industry, because it you know, you only have to provide slightly better wages in cotton mills than are available on the farm, and what's available on the farm, of course, is not very good. And this is true, you know, for blacks and whites. I mean, the entry-level wages in Southern industry were roughly the same for either race. Discrimination within the industry ultimately gives whites something of an advantage. But as far as unions are concerned, of course, they are anathema to Southern employers because they're going to mean higher wages, and so there's extremely strong resistance to them in the South from employers and the politicians and the people who are actually, ironically, the people who are supposed to work to improve economic conditions in the South find themselves supporting policies that ultimately are going to keep wages low by keeping unions out. So the Southern states lead the way, passing right to work laws and what have you. And of course from the national union perspective, the real push to unionize the South is part of the motivation is to prevent the flight of industry into these non-union states and away from unionized states in the North. So they're trying to establish enough of a union presence in the South to negate that advantage that the South might have in terms of recruiting new employers. And the South really is almost just a fortress against organized labor. And as, of course, time passes and industrial mobility goes global, it becomes increasingly hard for unions across the board to not advance, but just hold what they've got. And so today you've got what's most striking today is not the difference necessarily in the union rate, membership rate, between the South and the rest of the country as the fact that the national membership rate is now down so low. It's the national rate, I think, is probably lower now or almost as low as the Southern rate was, say, about 1960. So and a lot of that has to do, of course, with globalization.
I thank the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to talk about some more about political change, and I'm sure it would be the case for a long time that the South was essentially a one-party state. We had one party, essentially a one-party political system, and that was. That change, the big change, came with the civil rights movement, and particularly in the way that people responded to some of the things that the Kennedy administration did. So there, now we have the beginning of large numbers of Southerners who had been Democrats, and you can argue about whether, in fact, under other conditions they would have been, but they were Democrats. Well, now we have people moving to the Republican Party, and we see for the from that time to this, with the exception of the time that Jimmy Carter was the president, that the GOP sweeps the South.
Yeah, some people would argue we've gone back to being a one-party South. It's just the other party. Well, I mean, that does. I mean, it happens. I mean, and even though Southern Democrats are extremely conservative, you know, they're more conservative than conservative Republicans, generally speaking, when the South is a one-party region. They do, nonetheless, the same people who vote for these really arch-conservative Democrats for governor and Congress and what have you, do vote for the national Democratic nominee. I mean, they vote for Adlai Stevenson. They vote for John F. Kennedy. When the 60s come along and the Kennedy administration finally starts, after dragging its feet, finally sees no alternative to sort of getting on board with the civil rights movement, you get white Southerners who for generations upon generations have voted one party Democratic, and you get the old saying about the white Southerners would vote for a yellow dog if he was running as a Democrat, the yellow dog Democrat, suddenly, in almost an instant, that all that seems to fade, Barry Goldwater, who made a big deal in the South out of opposing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, carries five Southern states in 64, and then, when Lyndon Johnson very famously said upon passing the Civil Rights Act and with the Voting Rights Act coming pretty quickly on its heels, that the Democrats have lost the South for at least a generation. Well, that turned out to be a bit of an underestimation on Johnson's part. And so now you've got a situation where there have been Democratic presidents, even Jimmy Carter, who was the last president to put together anything remotely resembling a solid Democratic South. Even Jimmy Carter failed to get the majority of white votes in 1976. And in fact, I think it may well be that John F. Kennedy was the last Democratic presidential nominee to get a majority of Southern white votes. And it's become, the Democrats who have managed to pick off a Southern state here and there in presidential elections have done so by managing to get just enough white votes to go with a very substantial black vote. I mean, the Democrat candidates in the South average among black voters. I mean, they seldom drop below 85%, and can well be well up into the 90s. And the key is to get a big black turnout and find the right things to say to get enough white votes to make you competitive. And that's a very, very tough thing for the Democrats to pull off. Barack Obama carried Florida and North Carolina and Virginia, but they're a factor. Florida, of course, has a substantial, one of the few, it and Texas are really the only Southern states that have a substantial Hispanic vote. That makes a difference. North Carolina, Obama actually carries in part because of the strong run by a third-party candidate, Bob Barr, on the Libertarian ticket. Republican turnout is reasonably low and slack in Virginia, so I think we shouldn't see even those states as definitely shifting blue. But it's been a hard pull for Democratic candidates to in presidential elections to do very much, and over time this has crept into obviously into congressional races, Senate races, so that the Republicans dominate congressional delegations in both houses from the South, and it's now obviously made its way down the ticket, down into state politics, it is the Democratic prospects in this region are in metropolitan areas with a growing black and Hispanic population. They're showing some resurgence, but we're still a ways away from the point where we'd think we'd be back to a two-party system, a true two-party system in the sense of being competitive in the South.
All right, let's talk with another caller, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. What you're describing really is the victory of the South in the post-Civil War, that they actually won the Civil War. And my question is, how did they persuade the rest of the country that small government and states' rights were the right way to go?
Well, I'm not so sure that was all that hard a sell in many respects. the idea. Once you get, for one thing, you get the when you get the diminished clout of labor unions politically. There had never really been, in terms of big business power, and there had been always an interest in you know, government assistance where it was available, but you know, never really a tremendous fondness for lots of government regulation and oversight. And I think what, again though, what happens is that you get the 60s, along with the Civil Rights Movement and the Great Society programs, bring, you know, what appears to be this massive expansion of the federal presence that not only is horrifying to Southern politicians, but it really gets the attention of politicians in general. And you know, there are a lot of things that are happening here that you know, there's strong Northern support for school integration so long as it's Southern schools. I mean, you can just follow the you know, you can follow the more aggressive the courts become in pushing integration to the point where they're saying, you know, if it's we don't care if it's a result of de facto residential segregation in the North, as opposed to de jure school segregation in the South. Segregation is segregation in the schools, and you've got to address it. You know, which opens then the whole question of busing. You can see very quickly that you know, the Northern attitudes about continuing to push school integration go away. I mean, there's a tremendous drop in enthusiasm for it. And so I think that, again, here is that, you know, you've got these large cities that explode in racial violence in the 60s, and part of this is a buildup from the real boost in black migration to northern cities that the war brings. So this is, I don't think it's necessarily so much a case of the South convincing everybody else as other factors that simply sort of make this possible and open up politicians in other parts of the country to the idea that, you know, maybe we've let government get too big.
Well, I think you make a very good case for the American people being much less interested in democracy or favoring democracy than we would like to believe we are. Thank you.
Right. Well, this does raise this interesting kind of way of thinking that as people have looked at the rise of conservative Republican influence politically, the decline in the power of organized labor, the rise of evangelical Christianity, other sorts of things, popular culture, maybe less significant but more noticeable, that we associate with the South here, and then so we get into this this conversation about how it is that that the country has become more Southern, quote unquote, and in fact that the South has wrecked the rest of the country. And that's, you know, you can see that in people all over the country sitting in front of their television sets watching NASCAR, you know, that kind of thing. And I wonder what exactly you make of all of that, particularly this idea that the country had become Southernized, and that somehow that's contributed to national decline.
Well, I think I'm okay with that term Southernized, as long as you're is this sort of shorthand for to describe, you know, what you're talking about, you know, more conservative anti-union politics, more traditional fundamentalist religion, what have you. I think that term works that way, but it doesn't if you're talking about something that sort of flows insidiously out of the South and infects the rest of the country. That's when I began to have a problem, because there really is no explanation that I've seen advanced by anybody as to how that actually happened. You know, this would all these supposedly peculiarly Southern vices have been exported if there wasn't a market for this export outside the South. I think that again, what the nation is not is slow to come to grips with is the fact that there's really all along fundamentally probably more conservative than people realized, and that there've been just stimuli that come in the really in the 60s. I mean, I think is the tipping point where because you begin to notice the some of these reactions to I mean, you see George Wallace by the end of the 60s racking up huge numbers in northern presidential primaries, and that comes after racial violence in many northern cities. It comes at the point when the courts are just starting to press the issue of desegregating the schools in the north, and so it's just a sort of the nation has been sort of slow to come to grips with the fact that maybe the model, the sort of the liberal democratic model that had been applied to most of the rest of the country outside the South, maybe really didn't fit all along. It was a situational circumstance that, as long as our economy was growing, and the employers were still making money, they could put up with union pressures for higher wages and better benefits and what have you. But as global competition grows and there's not as much money to spread around, the unions become much more of a headache. The opportunity to transfer your operations to the Sun Belt, where taxes are cheaper and unions are practically non-existent, they become, become more attractive. And so there are a lot of structural changes going on that I think sort of in a new context, you find that attitudes change as contexts change. And it certainly, I'm not saying here that there's a level of observed or practiced racism, throughout the rest of the country that would compare to what we saw in the Jim Crow South. But that's not to say that it's not there on some level. Mm-hmm. And you can look at the presidential primaries this time. The Democratic primaries, Obama did better in a number of southern states among white voters than he did in states like Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. The used to be this kind of hardcore, blue-collar Democratic labor union presences there that you find the blue-collar whites outside the South now are a lot more likely to vote Republican. I'm inclined to think it's less a sort of a matter of a genuinely, distinctly Southern mindset pervading the rest of the country, is that we just are now sort of seeing the rest of the country in some ways in the same, closer to the same economic and racial context as the rest of the as the South, and we're getting to see some of the same characteristics.
Just have a couple of minutes here. I have an email I want to make sure I get in. Someone here writes, "We're now entering a 5-year period where the 150th anniversaries of some of the events of the Civil War will follow closely one on the other. Throwing a ball in South Carolina late last year was an odd way of marking the passage of the Ordinance of Secession, and the local NAACP chapter had good grounds for protesting it, especially given the echoes of that rhetoric of separation recently employed by right-wing politicians, such as Texas Governor Rick Perry." So the person listening here writes, "Do you think that these next 5 years we will see more use of the South's history in support of current political trends like the Tea Party?"
Well, I think we'll see it used in both ways. I think we'll see. I think we'll see more. It's being a secessionist. I happen to be writing a little piece about Robert E. Lee. I mean, the fact that Lee chose to fight for his state as opposed to his country is going to make him less controversial in a lot of people's eyes today, maybe than he would have been at other times in our history. So there's definitely going to be that. I think there's also going to be, protest from the NAACP and from African Americans about aspects of the sesquicentennial observance that appear to be validating the Confederacy and or its obvious ties to slavery, and astonishingly now that there still is a very strong contention of people who will argue that slavery had nothing to do with the Civil War. So I think this is going to be very different. I mean, the centennial observance was like, people were walking on eggshells and are really trying to stay away from any idea of relevance to the civil rights movement that's just starting to crank up then. But I think with the sesquicentennial, we're going to see this whole thing play out. I think the email is very perceptive in the sense that we're going to see this sort of restructured America, where not all the conservatism is located and is situated in the South. We're going to see people take different tacks on the positions of both the Union and Confederates for different reasons.
And just so you think, though, as we have already had some people observing that in the South, as they have talked about the war, there seems to be almost no mention at all of slavery. Will we see more of that, and is that going to continue to be a point of contention?
Well, I think we will see more of it because it's just going to be flagrant. I mean, I think in terms of it, as far as whites are concerned, it makes the whole business a lot less prickly. The less said about slavery, the better. And I've got the war. Was not really for a great many people who fought for the North and Northern politicians. It was not a war about slavery either. That's something in the ways that that Southern polemicists have sort of trying to write slavery out as part of their motivation. People who write from the Northern perspective have tended to write slavery into their motivation, or write abolition in as part of their motivation. And so we're just going to see another example of how the past, that whatever divisions you have that exist in the present, they're going to sort of somebody will seek out a proxy in the past, a proxy position, and so they'll reinterpret the past based through the lens of the present.
We have to stop there. Our guest, James Cobb, is B. Finnessy Spaulding Distinguished Professor at University of Georgia, written a lot about the history of the American South. His book is The South in America Since World War II, published by Oxford University Press. And Professor Cobb, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and thanks to the people who chipped in as well.
All right.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, first broadcast January 28th. Many past shows from Focus available for you to listen to anytime you're ready. Just go to our website, will.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com. WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
That's it for Focus for this morning. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices. In Kansas City, the May wheat contract is trading at 823 and a quarter, up 45. July, 833 and three quarters, up 45. May wheat in Chicago, 712, up 50. July, 746 and a half, up 50 and a half. May corn, 646 and a half, up 30. The July, September, and December contracts are all up 30. July, 653 and three quarters, September, 613, December, 579 and a quarter, all up 30. May soybeans, 1339, up 52. July, 1347, up 51 and three quarters. August, 1343 and a quarter, up